Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedian Tom Dreesen shares stories about being Frank Sinatra's opening act for 14 years.
There's 20,000 people out there, Christine. I want you to go out there, and I want you to, you're in the round now. They're all around you. They're behind you, and they're in front of you. You're in the round. I want you to go out there, and for the next 45 minutes, I want you to hold their attention. Oh, one more thing, Christine. I want you to hold their attention, but I want you to make them laugh for 45 minutes. Oh, one more thing, Christine. I want you to hold their attention and make them laugh, but I want you to make them laugh when you want them to laugh. I want you to pull the strings on the emotions of 20,000 people. No props, no tricks, no charts, no special arrangement, no special lighting, no orchestra, nothing but you and 20,000 people. And one more thing, Christine. Not one of them came to see you.
Today on the show, legendary comedian Tom Dreesen shares stories about Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. Stick around.
Hey, my name is Tom Dreesen, and you're listening to Story Worthy. 10 years, that's hard to believe. Happy anniversary, Christine.
My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show of over 10 years or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the story last week by comedian Bill Dawes talking about being detained in Egypt. Bill was doing one of those, a tour for the troops, and he was over in Saudi Arabia, and the show got canceled, so he thought, well, I'll just fly over to Egypt because it's very close. I'll spend the day, see the pyramids. That'll be cool. And then that's it, you know? So he goes down there by himself to Egypt. By the way, this is just 1 year ago. This is in July of 2019. So he goes and sees the pyramids. And Bill Dawes, he's smart. How smart? We're not sure. Basically, he gets scammed and then he gets arrested. And now he is detained in Egypt. And ladies and gentlemen, it is scary because they got his passport, they got his phone, and they got pictures of him mooning things because he's a comedian. And so he's mooning himself like by a beef eater by the Tower of London. And then he's mooning in front of the Eiffel Tower. And then he's mooning there and there and there. And now he's in Egypt. And I swear to God, you can Google Bill Dawes arrested in Cairo, Egypt. They claimed he was a homosexual who was trying to attract homosexuals to Egypt. Like, that's what the newspaper articles say over there. It's fucking really scary. Anyway, you guys, go back. Listen to Bill Dawes' harrowing story. It's like a Locked Up Abroad, I swear. But not today. Not today, because today I'm here with truly a legend. You heard me. Legend. I'm so happy to have him. I met him a couple of times, but it's always in like a comedy club passing, and I just never latched onto you, but now I have you. Tom Dreesen is here, ladies and gentlemen. And Tom brings forth the topic Sinatra, and boy, oh boy, you know, Frank Sinatra was just huge in my dad's life and my mom's life, but specifically my dad. And I listened to Sinatra all my life because of my dad. I think I only saw him twice. I think I saw Sinatra just twice in Atlantic City. And you might have been with him. What do I know, Tom? But my father, it was so impactful to my dad. And my dad sang very well as also. He wanted to be a crooner, but he had 6 kids by the time he was 33. So that dream was gone. So my dad, you know, he just listened to a lot of Sinatra, and he would talk about the orchestration, and he just, I don't know, it was interesting. He just never got off that one particular singer. I mean, his whole life, it's really interesting. Anyway, I just really hold Frank Sinatra dear to my heart because it connects me to my dad. And now I get to meet and speak with you, Tom Dreesen. And I know you spent 14 years on the road with Frank. So I'm very excited to hear your story.
Well, everybody says to me, you know, I was a stand-up comedian for a lot of years. This is my 50th year in show business. But people, wherever I go, no matter what I've done, no matter what I've accomplished in life, They'll always want to know about Frank Sinatra. I was running a marathon one time for multiple sclerosis, and the guy had a microphone in front of me, and he said, Tom Dreesen is about to run his first marathon. And Tom, we're live on CNN. He said, before you start, let me ask you, tell me about Frank Sinatra. What was it like touring with Frank Sinatra? So,
that is so funny. That's really funny, Tom. And before we get to your story, I want to ask you, you have done so much philanthropy. And I think that is just such a wonderful thing about you. You are like half comedy, half philanthropy, like two of my favorite things.
I appreciate that. I had eight brothers and sisters. We lived in a shack on the south side of Chicago, a suburb called Harvey, Illinois. We had no bathtub, no shower, no hot water. It was a rat-infested, roach-infested shack. And I remember real clearly when I was a little boy, both my parents were alcoholic at one time. But I remember that every Christmas or Thanksgiving, the local civic groups, the Moose, the Kiwanis, the Elks, JCs, they would bring baskets of fruit, of ham and turkey and fresh fruit and things that my brothers and sisters and I had never seen. And they would bring it to the shack, and my mom would always turn them away. My Irish mom, she would say, no, we don't deserve that. My husband has a job. But thank you very much. Yeah. Now, two things resonated in my mind all those years. Number one, my mother was right. He had a job and he should have been taking care of us. The other thing was, it wasn't the government bringing us food. It was people helping people, civic groups. There were no welfare in those days. So it was people helping people. And I never forgot that. I know Americans are the most generous people in the world. If you get out of their way, they won't let their neighbors starve. So that sort of charitable act to my brothers and sisters every year influenced me that later on when I had the opportunity to do the same things, the payback, that I would do that. And so, the other thing about my sister Darlene had multiple sclerosis. As I was growing up, I had a sister 18 months older than me. She never left my side. She held my hand walking across the street. We went to church 6 days out of seven. I was an altar boy. She was always there. If I sold newspapers, Darlene was there to help me. When my mom and dad were out drinking, or my mom worked in a bar, my older sister, who was only 18 months older, took care of us kids. When she finally started to live in her early 20s, she was stricken with multiple sclerosis, and it took her to a cane, to a walker, to a wheelchair, to bedridden. And I wanted to do something for her, so I was running a mile every day. And one day while I was running, I said, I'm going to run 26 miles and call it 26 miles for Darlene. And people will pledge money for every mile I run, and that would help raise money and also an awareness about this adult disease. Most people are sympathetic to children's diseases, and so adult problems, they're not as sympathetic. So I did this, and every year I would bring in celebrities to run part of the way with me, a block or two blocks or a mile. Frankie Avalon, Tony Danza, Eddie Marinaro, Smokey Robinson, Frankie Valli. There's so many stars that helped me. And they would run part of the way with me. Smokey Robinson's the only one who ran all 26 miles with me. And he's my dearest friend to this day. But I have to tell you, one day, and then we'll get to the other story. My sister Darlene never, ever complained in her whole life of anything, no matter what life threw at her. Darlene, she stood up to it and worked her way through it. And she knew I gave motivation speeches. I give motivation speeches on four subjects: perception, visualization, self-talk, and develop a sense of humor. And I elaborate on those four points. But I was always talking to Darlene about that. I read so many positive Atlanta 2 books. One day I went to visit her when I was in Chicago working with Frank Sinatra at the Chicago Theater. And I went south side to visit her. And her husband was out in the front yard mowing the lawn. And he said, Darlene's inside. I went in there and she had slumped over in her wheelchair and she couldn't right herself. And she had been like that for a long time. And I finally got her up and righted her. And she turned to me, this woman who never complained. And she said, don't you ever, ever come into talking to me again about positive mental attitude. And don't talk to me about God. Don't talk to me about God, because you've known me all my life, Tommy. What did I ever do to God that he would punish me like this? Come on, you always have these answers. Tell me, what did I ever do to God that he would punish me so severely like this? And I didn't know what to say. I'd never heard this girl complain. And I said, I don't know, Darlene, I don't know. And a few minutes later, she started crying and she said, I'm so sorry, Tommy, I lost my faith. Please forgive me, I lost my faith. And I said, if anybody has a right to complain, you do. And that's when I told you that I was jogging one day and I thought I got to do something to show her that I care. Now, this 26 miles for Downing went on for years. And one day, 30,000 people were out in Park Forest, Illinois, and I had all my celebrities there, and they were on stage singing a song that was written for her and for MS patients called Don't Give Up. And Smokey Robinson and Frankie Avalon recorded it. Now, the Illinois Philharmonic Orchestra is playing, and in front of the orchestra are all these stars from Hollywood singing to Darlene and to all the people there. And she was in a van. She came up, and I was sitting with her, and I said, you remember one day you asked me why you? And to this day, I don't know why you, but I know because of you, 30,000 people are singing today on stage. And she said, no, Tommy, not because of me, because of you. And I said, no. All those things we learned in church about cast your bread and what you sow, you shall reap. All that love you gave me is now coming back to you. And so that's what it's all about. Yeah.
That is so beautiful. That is fantastic. So you must be a very good runner. Do you still run?
No, I can't. You know, through the years, I mean, I ran 54-mile relays. I ran three different marathons. I used to run with a relay team for NBC. We'd run 54-mile relays. But as years went by, a knee surgery, and then the hip, and finally the doctor said to me, Tommy, walk. You don't need to pound on those joints anymore. So I don't run anymore. But I do work out. You know.
Yeah. You look great, man. You've got the best head of hair in Hollywood. I'll tell you that.
I had nothing to do with that. I'm Irish and Italian, so on both sides of the family, they had that, you know.
You are very, very handsome, really. If somebody said, how old is Tom Dreesen? I'd say, I don't know, 58, 60. You look great.
Well, thank you. And we'll put it this way. Satchel Paige, a great baseball pitcher from the Negro League, Satchel Paige said, how old would you be if no one ever told you how old you were? And I always say I'm 38. Now, Clint Eastwood, a good friend of mine, I'm name dropping, forgive me, but Clint Eastwood's been a buddy of mine. In fact, Frank Sinatra introduced me to him 38 years ago, and we've been friends ever since. But he had a great line. I said to him, he's 90 years old now, and he's still directing film and acting. I said to him, how do you do it, Clint? How do you do it? He said, I don't let the old man in.
Wow. That is so cool. That is really cool. I love that. Now, I want to go back to two things real quick. Darlene, is she still with us?
No, she passed away. God rest her soul. And I always say this, you know, I went to Catholic school when I was growing up, and I went through all that, the stuff. If Downing isn't in heaven, then there is no heaven. I never met a finer human being in my life than my sister Darlene. She was as good a human being as you ever want to meet to everybody she ever met. And so if Downing's not in heaven, there isn't that heaven, you know.
Oh, that's really sweet. And then the other thing is, why would your mom? Okay, so like I grew up, it sounds like a lot like you, but it was the suburbs of Pittsburgh, but I'm one of six, big Catholic family, church on Sunday, confession, all that. And so my father would always say, we don't take charity. Blackburn doesn't take charity. So that has always influenced me. And I've been pretty good about that, although my sisters have lent me money. But other than like family, like I have never, I don't know. I'm just saying, like, is that why your mom wouldn't take that food? Because it seems to me those people were just trying to be generous.
Well, they were. And by the way, and God bless them, I grew up in a neighborhood with steel mills and factories and blue collar worker people. And the mantra in the neighborhood was you only deserve in life what you work for. I was taught that at a very early age. You only deserve in life what you work for. And so I shined shoes in taverns. I set pins in bowling alleys. I caddied in the summertime. I sold newspapers on the corner, all to help feed my brothers and sisters. And none of this do I regret. I always say that's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. All of life is about perception, you know, how you perceive it to be. And I perceive my childhood to be a blessing. You know, and I'll give you a quick story I tell when I give motivation speeches. I say a little boy goes out in the backyard and he's got a bat and a ball. And he said, I'm the greatest hitter in the world. And he throws a ball up in the air and he swings and he misses. He said, I'm the greatest hitter in the world. And he throws a ball up in the air the second time and he swings and he misses. He said, I am the greatest hitter in the world. And he throws it up the third time and he swings and he misses. He said, I'm the greatest pitcher in the world. Nothing changed but his perception. And all of life is how you perceive it.
Tom and I, we've been having some, you know, some technical difficulties because as we all know, you know, all of a sudden in the last 4 months, we've had to learn like 10 new systems, whether it's Squadcast or Crowdcast, Zencast, Zoom, Zoom Webinar. And sure enough, Tom and I had that same thing happen. And I got to say, let me ask you something, Tom. What do you think some of those legendary people you've known would think of like what we just went through and social media and technology and FaceTime and all this? What do you think Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra, what do you think these people would think?
Sammy Davis Jr., I toured with him for 3 years. Sammy would have tried to learn everything he could about this. Frank would have had an assistant do everything. He was the most impatient man you ever met in your life. The one thing you had to learn when you toured with Frank Sinatra was how impatient he was. First of all, he was never late for anything, ever. If he said, if you wanted him to be there at 9 o'clock, he was there at 5 to 9. If you weren't there at 9:01, he'd walk off. Frank Sinatra was never late for anything that he had one of the most important careers of all time, arguably the greatest career show business has ever known, but he was never late. And so if he said, how long are we going to do this? You'd say 15 minutes. He gave you that. If it went 18 minutes, he was gone.
Wow. I love that, actually. I mean, that's something my dad taught me, and maybe he learned it from Frank. I don't know, but it's true. And I have to say, over the last 630 episodes, no professional comedian, no professional actor or writer, they're not going to be late. They're just not.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Frank Sinatra told you the wheels up. We always flew in this private jet all over the world. He said, wheels up at 9 o'clock. If you showed up at 9:01, you were watching the plane go down the runway.
No shit.
Well, he told me, he said, Tommy, when somebody tells you to be in their office at 9:30 and you show up at 9:45, you just told them that your time is more important than theirs. He said, no one is that important. And again, that's just the way he was. So this modern day social media stuff would drive him up a wall. He would have to have somebody handle it for him, tell him when to walk in, he'd do the interview, and when to walk out. But as far as him handling a computer, you know, he wouldn't know how to turn a computer on or off, and didn't want to learn how to do that either. You know?
He was on the phone though, right?
Yeah, I mean, but you know, oftentimes I would get a call. Tommy, yeah, Mr. S wants to talk to you. Hey, Tommy, how you doing? But, you know, but he had people around him. He had more important things to do, you know. The show was the most important thing in the world to him.
Yeah.
When you know, you want to fool around, he never went to bed till the sun came up. We hung out, whether on the road or off the road, he stayed up till dawn every night. But when comes showtime, everybody better know their job, because he knew his job. Everybody in the orchestra, everybody and the opening act, I knew what he wanted me to do, and be professional, keep changing your material. And so he was a stickler about the show. I'll tell you a great story. One time I said to him, why do we wear tuxedos? He said, Tommy, if we were going to do a show for the king and the queen, would we wear tuxedos for royalty? I said, well, yeah. He said, that garage mechanic in Detroit and his wife, who's a waitress, who work all year long to save enough money to buy two tickets to come to our show, they're just as much royalty as a king and a queen. We dress for them the same way we dress for the king and the queen.
Wow. That's really interesting. Well, you, as a comedian, you always do wear a suit, don't you?
For Sammy Davis, when I toured with Sammy Davis, I said to him one time, because it's his show, and it was Frank's show in his audience, I said to Sammy, how do you want me to dress? He said, Tommy, we should dress at least as good enough as those who came to see us. So if in the old days in Vegas, dinner show, I'd wear a coat and tie. Second show, I could dress more casual. You know, I might wear a suit the first show. Second show, I'd wear a sport coat or some open collar, no tie. When I work at the Laugh Factory, like with you, and we're trying out new material, I'll dress casual, but I never dress sloppy. You know, that's just my 4 years in the military, and also my touring with these great legends, you know, Smokey Robinson and Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. and Gladys Knight and the Pips and Natalie Cole. I toured with some of the great artists of our time, and how they approached the show and how they respected their audience. You know,
I think that is such an interesting tip of what Sammy Davis Jr. said. Dress the way the audience comes to see you. That is a great idea.
He said at least as good as the audience had come to see you.
Yeah.
If you were going to do a corporate event and it was a black tie affair, then you would dress that way. But if you're doing a corporate event and people are coming in suits and ties and women in a dress attire, then you should dress at least, not come out with sloppy jeans and flip-flops, you know.
So what do you think Johnny Carson would have thought of technology?
Johnny probably would have learned it as well, because Johnny was into astronomy and all that stuff. You know, Johnny, and also was a guy who tried to stay up with the times.
You know? Yeah, well, you seem to be that way as well. Like, I feel like I'll always be that way. Somebody once said, if your kids pass you in technology, you're screwed.
Well, the problem with technology today, it's moving so fast. You know, since the invention of the wheel, technology is just moving. And, you know, you'll go to the store and buy a computer. By the time you get home and get it hooked up, it's outdated.
It's true. Now, a couple of minutes ago, you were talking about your hometown of Illinois. And I know that they named a street after you there. That's pretty cool.
To me, everything comes full circle. When I was a little boy, I was selling newspapers on the corner to help feed my brothers and sisters. And one day, all the horns are blowing. People were blowing horns. People were coming from everywhere, cars from everywhere. And I asked one of the elders, I said, what's going on? They said, Tom, it's Lou Boudreau Day. I said, Lou Boudreau? He said, Tom, Lou Boudreau is from Harvey in my hometown. He played for the Cleveland Indians at age 24. He played shortstop and he managed the team to a pennant in the World Series. And he's from our town and the whole town's going to celebrate him today. I was this little boy with newspapers. I went down to the corner of 155th Street where I sold newspapers. And I sold all my newspapers, and here come this parade and this famous guy, Lou Boudreau, Harvey Zone. He went inside the Elks Club, and he had lunch, came out, and he spoke to the crowd. And all the people were cheering, and I was thinking, he went away, and all the crowds were following him. And I was going home that day as a little boy, and I thought, wow, somebody from Harvey is famous. And he came back home, and like little boys, so I began to fantasize, maybe one day they'll have a parade for me. And I'm picturing the band and all. I'm a little boy fantasizing. And August 22nd, 1992, I went back to Harvey, Illinois, to that very same corner where I sold newspapers, where Lou Boudreau came out of the Elks Club. And they named that street after me. And the guy who introduced me to the crowd was Lou Boudreau.
Oh, my God. That, like, makes me want to cry. That is so beautiful.
Well, let me explain that, if I can. I read, when I was in the service, I grabbed every positive mental attitude book I could find. Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking, A Guide to Confident Living, W. Clement Stone, Positive Mental Attitude. But I read a book called The Power of Your Subconscious Mind by Joseph Murphy. Whatever the mind can see and believe, it will achieve. That fascinated me, how the subconscious mind works. The conscious mind has all these negatives in it and all the things and thoughts. But when you quiet the conscious mind, the subconscious mind only reacts to images and emotion. Whatever the mind can see and believe, it will achieve. The way it works is if you say, what was his name? What was his name? Doggone it, what was his name? 2 days later, you say, give me a cup of coffee. Bill Dawes, where'd that come from? You send a picture back to your subconscious mind with an emotion. It works off of image. Whatever the mind can see and believe, it will achieve. As a little boy, not realizing it, I programmed into my subconscious mind, wow, what if one day they have a parade for me and like Lou Boudreau? And it all makes sense to me. Look, I'll digress. When I was with the comedy team that split up, after 6 years, I came out here to the West Coast. I'm hitchhiking up and down Sunset Boulevard, begging to work for free at the Comedy Store. I couldn't even get on at the Comedy Store. I waited 30 nights to get a 5-minute audition for Mitzi, who owned the Comedy Store. I end up having no place to stay. I end up sleeping in an old MASH Rambler, an abandoned car up on blocks, and the front seat came down. So I would get up every morning and I would sleep in the car, and I'd get up every morning, wash up in the gas station. Every night before I'd go to bed, I would envision Johnny Carson talking to me saying, you're a funny guy, Tom Dreesen. You're a funny guy, Tom. I'd see it, I'd feel it, and I'd believe it. Just before you go to sleep at night, when you first wake up in the morning, the conscious mind is most at rest. So the subconscious mind is open to suggestion. So whatever the mind can see and believe, it will achieve. I couldn't get on at the Comedy Store. And I would see Johnny Carson saying, you're a funny guy. Now, knowing that if I'm sitting next to Johnny, I'd already succeeded over the other spot. Because in those days, you had to do 3 or 4 stand-up appearances on the show before Johnny let you sit down and talk to him.
Sure.
One appearance on The Tonight Show, and all of America said you made it. Wherever you went in 1975, they say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. The next question out of their mouth was, oh, yeah, you ever been on Johnny Carson? And if you hadn't been on Johnny Carson, in the eyes of America, you just weren't a comedian. You might want to be, but you're not now. Now, in my industry, to America, when you did a Tonight Show appearance, you had arrived. But to my industry, you hadn't arrived till you sat down and talked to Johnny. So that's what I saw. If I was sitting down talking to Johnny, I had succeeded. Now, I saw that, and I felt it, and I believed it. When I give motivation speeches, I hold up a picture of Johnny Carson talking to me. And I tell the class, this is the picture I image in my mind when I was sleeping in the abandoned car. Nothing can become a reality unless it's thought first. Everything you see in front of you, Christine, that microphone, those headphones, everything you see in front of you, they were thoughts before they became realities. The same thing applies to your life, the end results you want. And if you don't know what you want, a lot of people say, well, gee, I don't know specifically what I want, but I want to be a success. Well, then see a picture of them having a party for you and your mom seeing you or your brother or your husband or something. God bless you. You finally accomplished that, Ralph. You did what you wanted to do. You're so happy today. You know, see it, feel it, and believe it. And I'll get off the subject. The way it works is, this is your vehicle in life, this body you have. This is your airplane. It needs a flight plan. The pilot who flies a 747 every day from LA to Boston, he doesn't drive 100 miles an hour to the airport, go out on a tarmac, run aboard the aircraft, take off down the runway and say, now, where am I going? He files a flight plan. This vehicle you have, it wants to know, what's your flight plan? What is your flight plan? What do you want of me? So when you, again, you know, the way you're hypnotized, they put your conscious mind at rest and then they tell you to hop like a rabbit. How does that work? Because when your conscious mind is at rest, your subconscious mind is open to suggestion. So that's when you put the picture in there. You know, whatever the mind can see and believe, it will achieve. Now, you remember in school when we learned by repetition, but also by pictures. When they told me 3 times 7 was 21 when I was a kid, they'd tell me over and over. But when they held up the flashcard and I saw that 3 times 7 was 21, now that put a picture in my mind. You know, so again, I go back to the book, The Power of Your Subconscious Mind. It's been an incredible help to me my whole life.
Tom, you have learned so much, and you are one of those guys that just, you keep up. I love your knowledge. It's so impressive. I mean, not only the comedy, how did you ever stay away from the drugs and alcohol, or did you always stay away from that?
Not alcohol, because my parents are both drinkers, and I drank a lot of beer in my day. I thought that's what you did. I thought that's what a man did. He worked, and he came home from work. He stopped at the bar, had beers with the boys. And when I was in the service, I drank, you know, I drank when I came out of the service. You know, I remember sitting in bars at 2 o'clock in the morning saying to myself, I don't belong here, but I didn't know where I belonged. And I would pray, God, what am I supposed to be doing? You know, and I found comedy purely by accident, and it changed my whole life. But I drank a lot of beer. I could go out and drink, you know, 20 beers a night, you know, going from bar to bar.
Wow.
But one night, after the comedy team I was with split up, Tim Reed and I were America's first black and white comedy team. History shows we were the last. In fact, we wrote a book about what it was like being the first black and white comedy team. And there were no comedy clubs in those days. So we worked all black clubs in the North and the South, what they called affectionately the Chitlin Circuit, black owned, black operated nightclubs. And it was at 20 grand in Detroit, the High Chaparral in Chicago, the Sugar Shack in Boston, the Club Harlem in Atlantic City before they had gambling. And we worked all white nightclubs too. Paid more dues than any comedy team ever had to pay. But when the team split up, I thought I had never gone on stage without Tim Reed. I had never been on stage by myself. I thought my life was over. I had put so much faith and hope into the comedy team that I thought we were going to be the greatest comedy team, or I wanted us to be. And when Tim decided to split the team up, I was sitting in a bar one night drinking beer with my buddies and trying to think of what are my options. And it was like 2 o'clock in the morning or closing up the bar. I had two beers in front of me. And I'm sitting there thinking, I always was good at coming up with options. I said, I got one of three choices. I can either find another black guy and do the same act. I can get a job in a factory, which would have made my wife so happy. She hated show business with a passion. She hated show business. She wanted me out of show business. So I thought I could get a job in a factory and give up my dream, or I could go it alone. And sitting at the bar, I said to myself, I can go it alone. I'm going to do that. And I start saying, what are my goals? I want to get to the Johnny Carson show. And then I remembered a book I read by Clement Stone, Positive Mentalitude. He said, if you know what you want to do in life, and if it's a noble endeavor, search your life. And if there's anything that it can deter you from that noble achievement, get it out of your life. And I'm sitting there thinking, what could stop me if I wanted to make it as a stand-up comedian? And I looked down at that beer and I said, alcohol. Alcohol, it's ruined more people's lives, drugs and alcohol. And you can't have hangovers, you know, getting up every morning sick and tired and be a creative mind. And I pushed the two beers across the bar, and my buddy was tending bar. He came up. He said, you finished tonight, Tommy? I said, I'm through. I quit. He said, you quit for tonight? I said, I quit. He said, for tonight? I said, forever, I quit. He went, yeah, right. I'll see you here tomorrow night. And I never touched another drop again till I became a success. And one night I'm out with my wife, my ex-wife now. And I went out with her and I thought I'd have a beer. I tasted it and I didn't even like it. I haven't had a drink in years, you know.
That is fantastic. Wow. That's a great story. I remember my grandmother smoked like since she was like 13 to like 60. And she was so old and she was all bent over and she was tiny and she always coughed and she was a freaking mess. She had smoked for, it was like, I think it was 50 years. And then she quit. She just straight out quit. And I remember thinking like, well, that's not going to change anything. But in fact, she straightened up. She lost 20 years off her life, it seemed, and she lived till she was like 85.
God bless her. No, first of all, as comedians, I tell comedians this all the time. I told you earlier, I give motivation speeches. Sometimes I give one specifically for comedians called The Joy of Stand-Up Comedy and How to Get There. And I'll give a class at the Laugh Factory in Hollywood, or I've done it in Chicago, and I've done it in New York. But I tell young comedians, if you need chemicals to get you on stage, then you're not a true performer. You know, a true performer comes from the gut, right? From the gut, you know, and being honest with an audience, this is who I am. If it takes chemicals to get you on the stage, then you need to address that. You know, look, 85% of all stand-up comedians I met in my life, this is my humble opinion, 85% of all stand-up comedians are insecure, neurotic, sometimes psychotic, loved, starved wrecks, total wrecks. The other 15% are gifted, confident people who say, I know how to write a joke and I know how to tell a joke. I like to think that I'm in the latter, but never trust somebody that tells you they're sane. But my point of that is that look, I've known 5 comedians that committed suicide. I'm talking about great comedians, Richard Jenny, who I thought was one of the most prolific comedians I've met in my life. You know, Robin Williams, Freddie Prinze. I can go on with so many, but my point is that if you're an insecure, neurotic, love-starved wreck when you're poor and unknown, when you're rich and famous, it doesn't get better, you know, it gets worse because you thought rich and famous was going to take away this angst. And when it doesn't, now you're having a tough time. Now you got employees that you can dump on all day long. You know, what you need to do is the inner journey is far more exciting than the outer journey. Okay, you need to get that good well before you become a star, before you become this famous person. Again, only because fame and fortune doesn't get rid of your angst. Yeah. You need to address that, you know.
So it's like a combination of having to delay that gratification, you know, of letting drugs or alcohol take your mind off things, and they don't want to delay gratification. They want it right then. Or are you saying they need it to get on stage, or they need it to get further ahead?
Well, they need it. It becomes a crutch. In earlier days, you see guys going on stage with a couple of bottles of beer, having a couple of drinks before they go on. You know, that all of a sudden it becomes they can't go on without it. You know, they can't go on. You know, look, you know, there's 2 types of performers: those who want the love of an audience and those who need the love of an audience. Wanting the love of an audience is fine. You know, we all want approval. You want your boss at the bank to say, "Hey, good job." You know, or whatever. But what needing the love of an audience is a totally different animal. And Sammy Davis Jr. was one of those kind of guys. That's why he was such a great performer. But he was tortured in a lot of ways, you know. I remember he had a sign in his dressing room that he couldn't pay heed to. It said, "I don't know the meaning of success, but I do know the meaning of failure. It's when I try to make everybody love me." You can't do that. If you're a bartender, a truck driver, a bricklayer, whatever, you can't make everybody love you, but you go on stage with that. You want to make everybody love you. The other thing too is about the drug thing. A lot, you know, as a comedian, there's what is greater. Stand-up comedy is the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. When it works, when you wrote some new material and you're out there and you crush that crowd, that night with some new stuff you wrote, you walk off that stage, it's the highest of highs. There's no drug that can make you higher than that. A lot of performers want to keep that high going. So they, after the show, they try to get higher.
Yeah, it's hard to compartmentalize 6 minutes or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
With that in mind, haven't you ever played for the person in the back of the room who's not laughing? I mean, that's, I always think about, I the people that are laughing, my eye scans over them like, okay, I got them. Now, who is not listening? You know, isn't that true?
Well, here's what I tell young comedians. It's a conversation, not a presentation. Okay. Is it your act? You're damn right. It's your act. It's your job to make it look like it's not an act. Okay. So when you walk out there, you know, they're in our house. It's almost like, Christine, if your husband says to you, I'm making dinner. We got 20 people in the living room. Do me a favor. Dinner's not ready yet. Go out there and tell them some of those funny stories about when you're growing up, how your dad used to like to listen to Sinatra, whatever it is. And so you walk out in your living room and say, hey, dinner's going to be ready in about 20 minutes, but I got to tell you something. When I'm growing up, this is a story I've been wanting to tell you. Now, that's the way you go on stage every night. It's our house. It's not their house. It's our house. And if they could do what we do, they'd be up on stage. They can't do it. That's why they're out there. So you walk out into every club you ever go into with the frame of mind, this is my house. So that guy in the back, if he's not laughing or that woman in the back is not laughing, it might be that they're really interested in what you're saying, but they don't, a lot of people do not know how to guffaw. They can tee-hee, you know, tee-hee, you know, but I got a brother that he thinks a comic, he never laughed. His face will get red. He'll say to me, oh, that guy or that girl was so funny. I say, you never laughed. You never, some people aren't laughers, guffaws.
Wow. You know, that's funny. I never thought of that. Okay. I like that. Everything you just said, I'm on board. I totally love what you just said.
Think about this. Some people will not share their tears with you. They will cry alone. And a lot of people don't want to share their laughter with you. They're in a public place. You know how many times I've been on stage and this woman will have a great laugh. She'll go, ha, 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 and her husband will go, shh, quiet her down because she's got it. And I go right to him. I say, hey, knock it off. Let her laugh. I joke about it. I'll do a joke about that. But the point is, a lot of people are embarrassed with the sound of their laughter. So you got to make them very comfortable. You're in my house.
Where are you in the 8 children? Where did you fall?
I was 3rd.
Oh, interesting. So you were older than a lot of your siblings.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's what I did. I had to help, that's
raise
why I, you know, children of alcoholics bond. A woman wrote a book many years ago her name was Judy something, wrote a book about adult children of alcoholics was the name of the book.
Sure.
And when I read it, I thought I was reading my diary. You know, there's so many things that we do, that you do later in life. But the children bond. And my brothers and sisters and I are real close to this day.
Wow, that's nice. Are you the only one that went into show business?
Yes, I had a younger brother who has a good voice, and he still sings in a church in North Carolina. But I'm the only one that ever had the cojones to...
Yeah, the cojones. Yeah, I hear you.
To do this, you know, look, when you think about... I want to give you an example, your audience. When I opened for Frank Sinatra, now by that time I'd already done about 35 Tonight shows. I was a veteran. I toured with Sammy Davis, Smokey Robinson, all these other artists I told you about. I toured. When Frank asked me to come along with him, and we'll get to how I got that job, but one of the first things I had to do after I opened for him, we went to Nassau Coliseum, 20,000 people. He appeared in arenas with 20,000 people in Hawaii in front of 40,000 people. So I say to you, Christine, this is your assignment. It's 5 minutes before the show now. And you're getting ready to go on. And I say, Christine, there's 40,000 people or 20,000 people out there in the Nassau Coliseum, say. There's 20,000 people out there, Christine. I want you to go out there and I want you to, you're in the round now. They're all around you. They're behind you and they're in front of you. You're in the round. I want you to go out there and for the next 45 minutes, I want you to hold their attention. Oh, one more thing, Christine. I want you to hold their attention, but I want you to make them laugh for 45 minutes. Oh, one more thing, Christine. I want you to hold their attention and make them laugh. But I want you to make them laugh when you want them to laugh. I want you to pull the strings on the emotions of 20,000 people. No props, no tricks, no charts, no special arrangement, no special lighting, no orchestra, nothing. But you and 20,000 people. And one more thing, Christine, not one of them came to see you.
That is so darn funny, Tom. Oh, my gosh. And all of it is so true. But don't you think that maybe if you give the audience a little credit, like, look, Frank would not be touring, or Sammy Davis Jr. would not be touring with somebody who wasn't really polished. So maybe there's a little bit of power. Plus, they want to hear if you're going to announce them or like, when is he coming on? You know,
you can say all that, but I have to tell you, a lot of times those big arenas, it said Sinatra. When we went to Vegas, it said Tom Dreesen on the marquee in Atlantic City and a lot of, and it might even be in a program. But for the most part, most people that in the arena, the lights would go down and you'd hear, oh, and the orchestra would say, bum, ba, da, da, ba. People go, oh, ladies and gentlemen, the comedy star of our show, Tom Dreese. Oh, you would hear, oh, as you walk into the stage. Now, because I'm a veteran, I had a lot of experience. I walk out on that stage and I would say, and I'll show you the trick later. I'd say, how many of you out there, I want you to applaud. How many of you out there thought Frank Sinatra was coming out? Applaud. And they would applaud. I'd say, I know just how you feel. I'm a little bit disappointed myself. Now, the joke is on me. The first joke is on me. Now, then I would say, how many of you out there, I'm not doing my A material now. I'm saving that A material. I'm just now getting them focused on me. I got to bring them to me. And 20,000 people out there. So I'd say, how many people out there are in this arena for your very first time? Applaud. I didn't say raise your hand. I said applaud. I talk, you react. I talk, you react. So I say, how many of you out there are in this arena your very first time? Applaud. They'd applaud. I'd say, I'm talking to all of them. I'm walking around. I say, how many of you out there are seeing Frank Sinatra live your very first time? Applaud. And they'd applaud. I'd say, how many of you out there aren't wearing any underwear? Applaud. Now, they applaud. Point was, I'm bringing the me. I talk, you react. I talk, you react. I'm focusing him on me. And then I could start, and I'd always do a couple local jokes about that area. Now, I don't know if you read the paper the other day about what happened over here on the 405 expressway or whatever I was saying, and I would do a joke about their local area. I'd do a joke about their local politician or something that was in the news there. I'd do two or three jokes about that. Then I would go into my material. Bringing him to me, you know.
Tom, you are so polished. It's like Simon Says, you know, I'm going to do this and you're going to do this. And then I'm going to do this and you're going to do this. But it also is very similar to preaching.
Well, but by the way, I'm going to make a point about that. You know how I got polished? I failed. They weren't failures. They were successes. Every failure I had was a success, leading me to the area where I could do that. You know, now when you say a preacher, you know, whenever young comedians ask for advice, I say, watch those preachers. Watch those preachers, that those ministers in those big churches, not for their content. Watch how they mesmerize an audience with different colors. And they take them. You're going to be out there 45 minutes. It can't sound like this, Chris. Monotone. It's got to have colors. You know, when you're talking, you watch those preachers, how they'll take you up here and then they bring you back down and they take you over there. And they work that crowd and they bring them to the finale. And every show's got to have a beginning, a middle, and ending. Make sure that closure kicks them in the butt. And good night, everybody, on that big line, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting. It's like a boxing match, you know, like it's hitting and punching and backing up and backing up. And it's just this back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah, and never be afraid to fail. Never be afraid to risk. And by the way, if you're out there and it doesn't work, let them know it doesn't work. Wow, I thought you'd like that, but you know, they want you to succeed.
No kidding. Yeah,
they came there to laugh. When you announce a comedian, they came. They want you to succeed. You know.
Yeah. All right, you guys, he's here right now, Tom Dreesen. He is a comedian, obviously, and you're truly a legend, Tom. You're just one of the people that we've known forever, and you've been with some of the people that we've been so influenced by, and, you know, you were a regular on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson more than 60 times. You were friends with Johnny. You were a favorite guest of Letterman, and he also let you host Late Night with David Letterman several times when Dave wasn't there. And then you've also been an actor, and you appeared on really popular shows like Columbo and WKRP in Cincinnati and Murder, She Wrote. And then you also did films like Man in the Moon and Spaceballs. So you've done all these sorts of things, and you also have a Golden Palm star on the Walk of Fame in Palm Springs. You played these clubs and casinos in Vegas and Palm Springs, Atlantic City, with all these incredible people. And you've also written books. Recently, the book that just came out, Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra, came out in June of 2020. And you're just a fascinating person. So can't thank you enough for being here, Tom. I'm super excited to hear your story. And wherever you are, folks, put your hands together for Tom Dreesen.
I hear that applause. Wow, it's deafening. Yeah. And by the way, thank you for the plug on the book. The book is doing fantastic. It's, you can get it on Amazon.com. And it's just the reviews. I'm so blessed and so grateful. The reviews have been fantastic. And Amazon.com, they actually are in their second printing because it's going so well. But anyhow, wherever I go, no matter what I've done in my life, it always falls back to, tell me about Frank Sinatra. How did you meet Frank Sinatra? How did you ever get that job with Frank Sinatra, opening for Frank Sinatra? And this is how it happened. After I did my first appearance on The Tonight Show, my whole life changed. I was doing all kinds of shows, Dinosaur, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, Johnny Carson, Midnight Special, Rock Concert, Soul Train, American Bandstand, all the game shows, you know, $20,000 Pyramid and Family Feuds, all these shows.
Match Game. I think you were on Match Game for a while, right?
Oh, yeah, many times. You know, that was fun, too.
Hey, how was Soul Train?
I was the only white comedian to ever do Soul Train at that time because I have an album out in front of an all-black audience called That White Boy's Crazy. I'm the only white comedian ever to do a show in front of an all-black audience.
Awesome.
An album in front of an all-black audience. And by the way, Richard Pryor wanted me to call it That Honky's Crazy because, you know, he had an album called That N-Word's Crazy. But I said, no black guy that I grew up with, I grew up in an all-black neighborhood because my family was poor. I played basketball on an all-black basketball team. I played football on an all-black football team. So the black guys never called me honky. They called me white boy. And to this day, if I go back home and they'll see me, they'll say, hey, man, I was talking to him about that game we played. White boy, you were there. Come here, white boy. Tell him about that game we played. So when I did the album, I did it called That White Boy's Crazy.
But that's awesome.
One show that I wanted to do more than anything in the world was Sammy Davis Jr. had a show called Sammy and Company. And I got on that show and I did the whole routines about growing up in a black neighborhood, being the only white kid in an all-black situation. And Sammy fell off the couch laughing. He said, I'm going to take you on the road with me. And he did for 3 years. And all the time I was on the road with him, he talked to me about Frank Sinatra, how much he loved Frank Sinatra and what he learned from Frank Sinatra. And I had been a fan as a little boy when I was shining shoes in the bars. Frank was on all the jukeboxes. So now I'm touring with Smokey Robinson, and we're at Caesars in Lake Tahoe, and Frank Sinatra's appearing next door at Harrah's. Now, if you know Tahoe, Harrah's is like a casino away. I came off stage one night, and why I picked that night, I was there for a week. For some reason, I chose this night that I wanted to see Frank Sinatra's show. So I called Harrah's, and they said, don't worry about Tommy, we'll get you right in, because I had worked Harrah's many times. Now, I came off stage. I didn't change out of my stage clothes, and I'm running over to Harrah's Hotel. I'm running into the showroom because I didn't want to miss Frank Sinatra's opening. I had seen Frank perform. When Frank Sinatra walked out to the stage, to the microphone, he created more excitement walking to the microphone than most people do with their whole act. The whole room would just electrify Frank Sinatra, and he hadn't sung a note yet, and the room was up, you know, just up and electrified. So I didn't want to miss that opening. I'm running into the showroom. The vice president of Harrah's Hotel, a man named Holmes Hendrickson, saw me. He was talking to a heavyset guy with a cigar. And he said, Tommy, come here, come here. And I reluctantly went over because I didn't want to miss Frank's opening. And he said, Tommy, this is Mickey Rudin. Well, I recognized the name. That was Frank Sinatra's lawyer, and he was a very powerful guy. He said, Mickey, this is Tom Dreesen, and I think Tom would make a great opening act for Frank Sinatra. And the lawyer got a pained expression on his face like he heard it a million times. And he said, he winked at the vice president, and I caught the wink. He said, hey, kid, if I gave you a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000? I said, Mr. Rudin, put it this way. If you gave me a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000? And he started laughing. He threw that figure out there. He started laughing. He said, I like this kid. And a week later, I got a call. Would you like to work with Frank Sinatra for 1 week at the Golden Nugget in Atlantic City? And I said, oh, yeah. I said, I'll get my picture taken with him. I'll hang in every bar back in Chicago, and that'll be that. And the second night I toured with him at Atlantic City, the second night I was working with him in Atlantic City, he and his wife Barbara took me out to dinner, and I can remember like it was yesterday. In the middle of the meal, I was sitting across from him. He set his knife and his fork down, and he said to me, I like your material, and I like your style. I'd like you to do a few other dates with me if you're interested. And I didn't say, let me check my calendar. You know, I said, yeah. I mean, the great Frank Sinatra saying, if you're interested, what a marvelous show to me of humility. I said, yeah. Now, that turned into 14 years of 45, 50 cities a year. I stayed at his home 6 times a year, a friendship that I'll always treasure. At first, he was the boss of the tour. And you learned a lot of things from him as the boss of the tour, what he expected out of out of everybody on the show. And then he became a buddy. He, like I say, he never went to bed till the sun came up. Every morning, whether we were on the road or off the road, when the sun came up, Frank went to bed. So he wanted a buddy to hang with him, and I did that for years and got to really know him real well.
So real quick, so you would be flying around on his jet.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people did that jet hold?
It would hold probably 12 to 14, but it was never that many people. It would be Frank and me and sometimes Barbara, and it would be his secretary, Dorothy Ullman, and sometimes Susan Reynolds, his publicist. And that's how we traveled. And he and those private jet flights, sometimes he'd like me to sit next to him and talk. And sometimes you could see he wanted to be left alone. And I could pick up on that. As an ex-bartender, I think I picked up on people sometimes. I have a sense about people that when I first met Frank, I realized he didn't need another fan. He had millions of fans.
Yeah.
He needed a pal. I never let him know how much in awe of him I was. Never. He never saw that part of me.
Wow. That's interesting. That would be hard to disguise.
Oh, of course, because you know how many times I wanted to say, you know, when you did From Here to Eternity, in that movie, The Manchurian Candidate. But he had enough fans. He wanted a pal, a buddy, somebody he could talk about. When we got in the car alone, when I stayed at his compound, he had a compound down in Rancho Mirage, a huge compound. On it is a main house, swimming pools, tennis courts. But on the outer perimeters were bungalows, and the bungalows were named after his songs. Strangers in a Night, Tender Trap, My Way, New York, New York. And his house guests would be Gregory Peck and his wife, Veronique. It'd be Kirk Douglas and his wife, Anne.
Wow.
It'd be Jack Lemmon and his wife, Felicia. It would be Angie Dickinson. It'd be Clint Eastwood and whoever he was dating at the time. It would be Admiral Shepard, the first man in space, Isaac Stern, these incredible house guests. And he would come and get me at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, Tommy, let's take a ride. He stayed up till dawn and we'd ride around the desert all night long.
Wow.
But later in life, my point of this is when we'd be in the car alone, he wouldn't be the great Frank Sinatra. He would be a kid from Hoboken and I was a kid from Harvey, Illinois. And that's how we related to one another.
Drive during the night, right?
Yeah. I would drive him around the desert, yeah.
And then, if you were traveling and he was waiting until the sun came up to go to bed, how would he always have a hotel room right there? If he was on the plane, how would he get darkness? You know what I'm saying?
No. Yeah, when he was home, that's what he would do. He would catnap during the day, but he would not go to bed till the sun came up. But on the road, he did the same thing in his suite. Rarely did I ever see him at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, he'd catnap during the day, and around 5-6 o'clock at night, he'd start rolling. He was nocturnal. When the sun went down.
Yeah. Did he exercise?
Years ago, he used to swim a lot. He swam underwater because it gave his lungs greater capacity to hold those notes. You know why Frank Sinatra was the greatest singer of all time, the greatest pop singer of all time, not even arguably. Is because of his voice technique. He once told me an interesting story. He said, when he was with the Tommy Dorsey band, my question to him was, I said, when you were growing up, when you were a new singer, who did you emulate? Because comedians, we look at other comedians and try to be somewhat like them. And he said, I didn't want to be like anybody. He liked Bing Crosby when he was a crooner, but he said, I wanted to breathe different than all of them. And I said, breathe different? He said, Tommy, when I was in the Tommy Dorsey band, there was a boy singer and a girl singer in a big orchestra. After we finished our numbers or before, we sat there on stage. I would watch Tommy Dorsey, the great trombone player, playing, and I watch his back, and he's playing like 18 bars with his trombone, and I never saw him go for air. I never saw his back expand. You know, really, ba-da, ba-da-da-da-da, ba-da, ba-da-da-da-da, ba-da. And he said, I said to him one time, how do you do that? I never see you take air. He said, I learned to do something that you singers can't do. I take air through the corner of my mouth. And Frank said, I can do that. Frank began to learn how to breathe through the corner of his air. That's why you never saw Frank Sinatra ever gasp in a song. You never saw him go, to sing the next note. You will be my music. You will be my song. And he would take air through the corner of his mouth and it would circulate in his mouth. So he had tremendous breath control. And the other reason why he was a great singer, sitting around with him one night with Gregory Peck, Clint Eastwood, Robert Wagner, Jack Lemmon, Kirk Douglas, all these great actors. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. They were talking about acting and film and directing, and I was fascinated. I just sat back off to the side, fascinated. And they were showing such great reverence to Frank Sinatra, these learned actors. And I was curious, I said, because I studied acting in Chicago and I studied acting out here in LA. And I said, I was curious, Frank, who'd you study with? Did you study acting? And Gregory Peck grabbed my arm fiercely. He said, ugh, acting lessons would have ruined him. He was a diamond in a rough you don't fool with. Acting lessons would have ruined him. So my point of that is, here's a guy who won the Academy Award in From Here to Eternity. What about the Manchurian Candidate? What about the Man with the Golden Arm, where he should have won the Academy Award? So what a brilliant actor. So when you handed Frank Sinatra a song, to him it was a script. What did the writer feel the night the writer took pen in hand? He would immerse himself in that lyric and become that lonely guy in the bar. His woman left him, and he's never going to find love again. And you felt that. You felt that pain, and you felt the joy of his songs. Come fly with me, let's fly away. You know, his interpretation of lyrics was like no other. You know, I think it was Charlton Heston once said, to watch Frank Sinatra sing a four-minute song is like watching a four-minute movie. Yeah, Steve Lawrence once said to him, and Steve Lawrence is a great singer, brilliant singer. Steve Lawrence said, you know, you ruined it for all the rest of us. Because once they heard you sing it, they knew how it's supposed to be sung.
Yeah, I believe that. Wow. It's so interesting. So you think a lot of that came from acting in a way?
Well, he was born with the gift. My mother had a wonderful old plaque in the kitchen said, the talent you have, it's God's gift to you. What you do with that talent is your gift to God.
Wow. You know, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, but he had a guy named Murphy when he was a young guy, a voice coach in New York. I think he told me it cost him like $1 an hour, which was a lot of money in those days. But he learned vocal lessons from him and things like that. Every night, I'm digressing for a moment, but every night in his dressing room, I could hear him getting ready to go on. Or even at home, when I sit at his home, he would have a piano there and he did a key. And he'd go, come and take a walk with me. And he'd hit another key. Boom. Come and take a walk with me. And he'd take it up another octave and another octave. And that's how he vocalized. That he learned that when he was a kid in New York. And he did that his whole life till his last song, which, by the way, the very last song he ever sang on stage is The Best Is Yet to Come. It was the last song he sang. I was with him that night. And that's on his tombstone. The Best Is Yet to Come, Francis Albert Sinatra.
That's very beautiful. Was that in Palm Desert?
Yeah, that was at the Marriott Hotel in Palm Desert. And now they're going to name that room the Frank Sinatra Ballroom, and I'm going to go down there and help them dedicate it.
Ah, Tom, that would be so wonderful for you to do. That would be great. Did he really drink Jack Daniels like people talk about?
Jack and a splash. That was his drink of choice. He used to take a sip of it and say, ah, the nectar of the gods. And he would, later in his career, a Scotch company was going to sponsor his tour for millions of dollars for a summer tour that we were taking, millions of dollars. And Frank was told it. It's all right, all right. Now they put the Scotch in the, every night around his two last songs, he would stop to toast the audience. And his toast always was, may you live to be 150 years old and the last voice you hear is mine. And he would toast the audience, right? Anyhow, and it was Jack and the Splash, and you go, ah, the nectar of the gods. Now, he did that for years. Now, this Scotch tour, the first night of it, that and Frank was told, you know, the Scotch people are out in the audience. There's like 200 of them in this big arena, and all their clients and their buyers. I'll never forget this as long as I live. In the wings is his lawyer, all the people who put this millions of dollar deal together. And Frank, again, getting to almost the last song, he said, ah, it's toast time. May you all live to be 100 and 150, and the last voice here is mine. He goes, salud. And he goes, like, he takes a sip and goes, what kind of shit is this? Oh, my God. The people in the audience, oh, my God. The people were laughing because they didn't know, but the client was, and the lawyer, his face, the blood drained out of his face. Oh, God.
That is so funny. So they thought they could switch his Scotch then, even if he was promoting it?
They should have let him know ahead of time, taste ahead of time. But they did tell him he didn't know, but he just forgot. You know, for 50 years, he's been drinking Jack Daniels and toasting the audience, you know.
Somebody said he was buried with a with a bottle of Jack Daniels. Is that true?
Yes, he was. And ironically, with a dime in his little vest pocket, because years ago when the children were little, he always told his kids, always keep a dime on you so you can call me no matter what. Just keep a dime. So if you need me, you go right to a phone, you know, and call me. Today, young kids don't even know what a payphone is, you know.
Right, of course. So you think he was a good dad?
I know he loved his children very much, yeah. And his children would tell you that he had a strange relationship with his son. And his son, Frank Jr., was a real good singer himself. And by the way, conducted for us the last 7 years. I toured with Frank 14 years. The last 7 years, Frank Jr. was a conductor and a very serious guy, a great musician. They didn't have a great father-son relationship. It was kind of sad. And to be honest with you, toward the end of Frank's life, he treated me like that. I think I was more, Frank and I had so much in common. He had three children, girl, boy, girl. I had girl, boy, girl, three children. I'm half Sicilian. He's half Sicilian. I grew up around saloons. He grew up around saloons. His mom and dad owned a saloon called Marty O'Brien's Bar and Grill. His dad boxed under the name of Marty O'Brien because there was so much prejudice against Italians that Italians fought under Irish names in those days. So we were both street kids. A guy from the New York Times one time was walking out of a Chipachi's restaurant in New York. Frank and I were having dinner. And the guy knew me. He had done a story on me years before. And he stopped by the table to say hello to me. I know he wanted to say hello to Frank, but a lot of people did that to me. They'd walk by, hey, Tommy, how you? Frank, I got to tell you, I love you. But this guy stopped and he said to Frank, why do you keep Tom Dreesen on your show all these years? And Frank said, you mean besides the fact that he's funny? And the guy said, yeah, besides that fact. Frank said, well, if I'm a saloon singer, and I am, then Tommy's a saloon comedian. By that, I mean, we're just a couple of neighborhood guys. And I never forgot that quote. And because that's how I felt when I was alone with him. We were just a couple of neighborhood guys. But he was so special. It's so hard to believe the magnitude of this star. At age 78, he sold out in Japan. And, he was a major star for 60 years, a major star. Now, most people are stars 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, maybe 60 years. He sold out in Argentina. One time in Brazil, 175,000 people came to see him. The largest audience for a single performer. Now, rock groups have drawn maybe that many, but not a single performer. He sold out in foreign lands in Russia. What English singer, English-speaking singer, does that? You know, aside from all that movie star, he was a singing star, a movie star, but was he in the mob? That all that mafia stuff around him, that mystique around him. Like I say, when he walked out on stage in front of 40,000 people, you'd have thought it was a second coming. You know, he was really something special. Can I tell you a quick joke I told him one time?
Please, yeah.
I said a guy died and went to heaven. And as he was entering, St. Peter was entering the pearly gates, the guy heard this incredible music of this incredible orchestra doing My Way, Strangers in the Night, Tender Trap, I'm a Fool to Want You, hearing this music. And he's walking with St. Peter and he said, wow, can I go over to hear that music? He said, sure. And St. Peter takes him over and there's a big band shell and there's a huge 150-piece orchestra on stage. And all of a sudden, a lonely figure starts walking out to the center stage to the microphone. And the guy said to St. Peter, who's that? And St. Peter looked, he said, oh, that's God. He thinks he's Sinatra.
That's a perfect joke. That is super funny, Tom. That is super funny. Wow. Do you think any of that mob stuff was true?
Well, here's the thing. When people say that, which I got to tell you, I could talk for an hour and a half about Frank Sinatra. And at the end of it all, I'll say, are there any questions? Now, I talked about his music. I talked about his everything that he's done, his acting. And I'll say, are there any questions? And somebody will raise their hand and say, was Frank Sinatra in the mafia? It's always that question. Now, let me tell you this. Did he know those guys? Of course he knew those guys. They owned the show business. Do you know when he started out all across the land that every jukebox in America, how important it was to get your records on the jukebox? Do you know who owned those jukeboxes? The syndicate, the mafia. They owned the jukeboxes. They put the jukeboxes in all the bars. Did he know those guys? He wanted to get on those direct. Now, they also owned recording companies. The mob guys owned it. And they also owned Las Vegas back in the day. So did he know those guys? I knew those guys in Chicago. I mean, they hire you. You know, they prefer. Now, Dean Martin gave me the best advice. Dean said to me, Tommy, keep them at arm's length. Show respect, but keep them at arm's length. Don't accept any favors. If they would say to me, there was a guy, I can talk about it now. There was a guy, the movie Casino, you know, remember the movie
Sure.
Casino? The character Joe Pesci played, you know, Tony Spilotro. Joe asked me, he said, Tommy, I know you knew Tony Spilotro before the movie. He said, tell me some things about him, you know, because Joe was rehearsing for the role. But I would be in Las Vegas, and this guy was in the Black Book. Tony Spilotro was not allowed to be in any casino. That's what they call the Black Book. But that's the only place I saw him, was in a casino. But if he saw me, he was a Chicago guy. And if he saw me, he'd say, hey, Tommy, come here. And he'd be with a couple other guys. He'd reach in his pocket, pull out a wad of $100 bills real thick. And he'd say, Tommy, you need something? You want some? I'd say, no, I'm fine. And I'm being honest, he'd say, you want a girl in a room? You want a couple girls in a room? I said, no, I'm fine. Thank you. I remember what Dean said to me. Do not accept favors. Be respectful. But don't, because if they do you a favor, they expect a favor in return. And that's what Frank Sinatra told me years later. The last 20 years of his life, he said, I rue the day that I ever met those guys because they won't get out of your life. He said, you do a favor for a guy or a guy does a favor for you years ago. He said, then years later, his son comes to you and said, and you pay the guy back with a show or something. He said, then years later, his son comes to you and said, you know, my dad did a favor for you. And so you do the favor. He said, years later, the grandson comes and says, you know, my grandfather did a favor. He said, they won't get out of your life. So that's the lesson I learned, you know.
Well, that's super interesting. And you're talking about, of course, illegal activities. But then when you talk about your philanthropy, all you do is give, Tom.
Well, again, I explained that to you earlier that I, first of all, if you're an entertainer like you and I are, and somebody says, Christine, we're doing a show for multiple sclerosis, or we're doing a show for cancer, or doing a show for the children. It's Saturday night. Could you do for 20 minutes? And you aren't doing anything that night? You say, of course. You can't keep taking from the stream. We are the luckiest people on this planet. I make a living at what I love to do. I love making people laugh, and I'm paid for that. I have to tell you, the first time I ever went on stage with Tim Reed, something I had written got a laugh. And that moment, it was like an epiphany. Like an old B movie where the dark clouds open up and the sun bursts through. And I went, yeah, my whole being went, oh yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to be a stand-up comedian. I couldn't sleep that whole night. It was a Friday night. On the Saturday morning, I couldn't sleep the whole night. Saturday morning, I got up and I rushed to the church where I used to be an altar boy, where I sang in the choir when I was a little boy. And it was a church that my mom sang in that choir when she was a little girl. And I, no one was in church. It was an empty church. I got on my hands and knees and I prayed. I said, God, I now know what I want to do. I want to be a comedian. If you let me make my living as a comedian, I'll never do ask for any other. I'll do charities. I promise you, Lord, if I could make my living as a comedian, I'll give back. Now, the thought that you can make a living making people laugh overwhelmed me. Now, all my dreams have come true. 50 years in show business. I went back to that same church last September on the 50th anniversary, 2019, on the 50th anniversary of me being in Children's, of me saying that prayer. And I gave a sermon to the church called The Power of Prayer. And I told the church, I knelt right over there and I asked God, and God answered my prayer. You know,
so beautiful. Another word for that is that you found your purpose early in life. You had that epiphany.
To find the work that you love is the greatest thing that could ever happen to any human being. You know, to find the work that you love. I wrote a poem years ago called The Sound of Laughter. I'm not going to do it for you. In fact, it's at the end of my book. The poem is there. But the opening is, as far back as I can remember or shortly thereafter, I love to hear the sound of laughter. And the rest is the poem. But
that's beautiful. Yeah, that's beautiful. Tom, you are fascinating. You are wonderful. I'm so happy you are healthy and strong. What do you do in your spare time now, especially with COVID? What are you doing?
Well, I do a lot of motivation speeches. This book has gotten me so busy. Amazon.com is where you get the book. It's a cheap plug, forgive me, but I'm doing shows like yours. I'm doing podcasts. I'm doing radio shows. I'm doing Zooms all over the place. And so I'm keeping busy with that. Plus, I like to give a motivation talk every now and then to somebody. I'll call somebody that needs a little boost, you know. Again, it's all part of payback. I want to say this to you and to all the stand-up comedians that are listening to this show. I want you to think about what I'm about to tell you. You are in the greatest profession ever put on this planet, and for a good reason, because laughter brings healing to people. Let me digress for a minute. They did a survey around the world for 8 years of the 10 fears of men. They did this years ago. And the 10 fears of men, death was fourth, pain was second, getting up in front of an audience was the number one fear of mankind. So if you can get up in front of an audience and you're a house painter and you're going to talk about house painting for an hour, you're in less than 1% of the population of the world. If you're a lawyer or a doctor, you're in less than 1% of the population of the world. If you can get up and make people laugh for an hour, you're in less than 1/1000th of 1% of the population of the world. Do you know how fortunate you are that you can make people laugh? Because this is, laughter is healing. It's a God-given gift that you have because it's healing, and it's not a theory anymore. Norman Cousins, the man who wrote the book Laughter Math, and he wrote another book called The Anatomy of an Illness. He was the editor of Saturday Review. He had a terminal illness. He was going to die, a heart condition. They put him in a hospital, and the doctors told him because of years of stress, negative input, it created this heart condition, and he didn't have long to live. He laid in the hospital, and he thought, if negative input, stress made me ill, then positive input should make me well. So he checked out of the hospital, and he only watched I Love Lucy reruns, Candid Camera, Three Stooges, The Marx Brothers. He listened to comedy albums. He didn't watch the evening news. He didn't read the newspapers. He'd watch comedians perform. Now, he lived 27 years after the doctors told him he was going to die. And so that's why he wrote the book Laughter Math and the Anatomy of an Illness. So we've always known that laughter is psychologically a deterrent, that the brain can't think of two thoughts at the same time. So if you're watching a comedian perform, you're not thinking of your problem. So laughter is psychologically a deterrent. But now we know, because of Norman Cousins, UCLA did research, that what happens to the human body when it laughs, if you had a hearty laugh and you're laughing so hard and afterward you go, tears rolling down your eyes and you go, oh, and the sense of well-being comes over your body's gone through an actual chemical change that they know because of the laughter, that laughter creates out of the brain endorphins that are released into the bloodstream, chemicals. So there's an actual chemical change comes over your body from laughing. So laughter is not only psychologically a deterrent, it's physiologically therapeutic. So comedians are physicians of the soul, Dr. Christine.
You're amazing. That's so wonderful. I totally agree. I started this new show on Sunday nights, like I was talking about, and I've had a couple of people have told me, like, you know, like, I don't know how you're doing this right now during COVID, and like, I can't perform right now. I don't want to do this right now. And I felt like, oh no, do I not have enough empathy, or why am I still wanting to perform? And then I think like, well, that's because that's what I bring to the table. You know what I mean? Like, I can't protest. I have a daughter, you know, I have to. So what I can bring to the table is, you know, not the hunting and gathering, but the dancing around the fire.
Yeah, that's, you know, well, that's what it is. It's, it isn't, you know, all of us who, it rains in all of our lives. It rains in all of our lives. There's no life without rain. We learn how to dance in the rain.
Yeah.
You know, that's all.
That's awesome.
You know, yeah.
Tom, you have been the longest guest I've ever had on my show. I'm not kidding you. I'm going to break this up into two parts. That's what I'm going to do. But before we go, tell me if you can, and I know it's a big question, but just, can you just tell me a little bit about Frank's funeral in Beverly Hills? And was there any laughter that day?
Well, here's what happened at Frank's funeral. It was in Our Lady of Good Shepherd in Beverly Hills. I'm going to digress with a little thing that'll tag the ending. Everywhere I went with Frank Sinatra, when I brought friends backstage, he never once refused any of my friends. In the 14 years, I brought back guys from the neighborhood, men and women from the neighborhood, friends, family. He never refused to meet him. My mother, and I brought, you know, a guy who drove a bread truck. I brought the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. I brought back senators, congressmen, whoever I brought back, he would greet them. But he was always polite to them, but he was especially polite, if I can use his phrase, to the little guy, the guy who drove a bread truck. He'd say, a bread truck? Now tell me, do you have that Italian bread? He would show more attention to that, the little guy, not the big star in the room. And I always found that just so touching because that's where I came from. I came from those kind of.
Yeah, I love that. And often it's more interesting because it's something you don't know about. You know about the star's life or the performing life, like you know that, but you don't know about how, you know, the conductor does something on, you know, especially the orchestra people. I'd have 1,000 questions.
Sure. Well, he was always paid special tribute. I brought nuns that taught me backstage and he spent time with them. And so anyhow, at his funeral, now, whenever people say, what's the grandest thing that you've ever had to do with Frank Sinatra? I did so many things with him working, doing shows at the White House. But that funeral, in that audience was everybody who was anybody in the world, in that church, and people of great magnitude who couldn't get in the church. But that church, now, I'm the master of ceremonies and I'm the first speaker. Now, I know Frank would want me to make them laugh. I know every night before I went on stage, walking by his dressing room, he'd say, Tommy, you going on? And I'd say, yeah. He'd say, be funny and be brief. He was always say, be funny and be brief. You know. Now, when I said to the priest before the church, I took my daughter Amy with me to the church. We sat in one of the front pews because I was the first speaker. I said to the priest, when will I speak? He said, after communion, Tom. I said, okay. Now, before communion was over, I went up to the front, up to the church on the side, and I waited off to the side, and the lectern was out in the center of the church, of the altar. And when communion was over, I looked at the priest, and he motioned me to stay where I'm at. And all of a sudden, the choir starts singing Ave Maria, and I'm getting melancholy. I used to say, Frank used to say to me, Tommy, Sicilians don't cry. They cry alone. I said, but I'm half Irish. He said, well, Irish cry when they change bus drivers, you know, so. It was Frank's line to me all the time. So now I'm there and I'm thinking, I don't want to cry. I don't want to get choked up. So while they're playing Ave Maria, the problem with when you're in a funeral, it reminds you of all the other funerals you've been to, my mom, my dad. So I'm looking over to the side. I said, gee, they should paint that wall over there. The plaster's falling down over there. And I was getting my mind off of this. Now, finally, Ave Maria's over. And I look over at the priest and he motions me to stay still again. All of a sudden, the church got so quiet, you could actually hear the pews crackling. And Frank Sinatra's voice comes over the loudspeaker. Put your dreams away for another day. His signature song that he on a TV show. And the whole church burst into tears. I'm looking at them from my angle, and I'm looking at Gregory Peck, Kirk Douglas, Jack Lemmon. I'm looking at James Darren, my good buddy and Frank's friend of Frank's. I'm looking at all these. And his wife, Barbara, and his wife, Nancy, first wife, Nancy, and Mia Farrow, they're all sitting together, shoulder to shoulder. Frank and his wife, Ava Gardner, had passed away, or they'd all been there. The whole church is sobbing now. I see Vic Damone with his head in his hands and Tony Bennett shaking, crying, and Frank singing the voice. It was so touching and moving. I thought, no, I can't let this happen. So I turn away and I'm thinking, gee, I wonder if they play bingo in this basement. And I'm thinking everything I could to get my mind off of. Now the song is over and people are wiping tears out of their eyes and the priest motioned me to the lectern. Now I'm walking to the lectern thinking, Frank, of all the performances that I've had opening for you, this has got to be the toughest because I know he'd want me to make him laugh. I said, all of you out there know that Frank Sinatra liked to stay up till dawn. And a lot of you, like me, had to stay up till dawn with him. And he loved that. And it was fun for about 10 years, but as years go by, you get a little tired of that. And there was a little chuckling, you know. And I said, and first of all, I'll go on with the story, but I want to digress. Everybody knew Frank Sinatra tipped $100 wherever he went. Whatever you gave him a pack of camels, you got $100. You brought him you brought him a jacket and a splash, you got $100. He didn't show off, he'd slip it to you. The joke everybody knew in the church was, and I didn't do it that day, but that one time Frank was coming out of Miami Sound restaurant and a valet Parker brought his car up and Frank said, what's the biggest tip you ever got? And the kid said $100. And Frank took out two $100 bills and gave it to him. And he's getting in the car and he turned around and he said, by the way, who gave you the $100? He said, you did last Friday, Mr. Sinatra. You know, now everybody in the church knew that story that Frank tipped $100. So now I'm telling the story. I said, Frank wanted me to step into the dawn and so forth and so on. I said, and a lot of you had to do it. I said, but after about 10 years, one night we flew into Fort Lauderdale. We were going to perform for a whole week, one night in Fort Myer, one night in Sarasota, and one night in Daytona, all one-nighters that we'd take the private jet to. But then at the end of the week, we were coming to the Sunrise Theater, and we were going to work there. But the first night we head off, the private jet landed, squad cars and limousines rush us to the hotel. Frank gets out, they go straight into the lounge, and I sneak up to my room. And I'm telling the church this. I said, I made it to my room. I'm going to get up and play golf in the morning. I don't have to hang out all night. 5 minutes later, I hear a pounding on the door. I open the door, and there's a big red-headed bellman. Had a crew cut, looked like a linebacker for the Miami Dolphins. He said, Mr. Dreesen, Mr. Sinatra wants you downstairs in the lounge. And I reach in my pocket. I pulled out $20. I said, I tried to hand it to him. I said, could you tell me? He couldn't find me. He said, Mr. Sinatra gave me $100 to tell you he wants you downstairs in the lounge. Now, I know my $20 doesn't look like it's going to make it. So I said, couldn't you tell me you couldn't find me? He said, Mr. Sinatra said, if you resist and I had to drag you down there, he'd give me $200. I know I'm going. And the whole church broke into laughter, you know, and I went down and Frank patted me on the cheek. He said, hey, Pally, let's hang out. And we hung out till dawn. But the whole church, what I realized is that they needed that laughter, that, you know, that they needed some comic relief. I didn't realize that at the time, but afterward, it got such a huge laugh. And I know that would have made Frank so happy. That would have made him so happy.
Oh,
now, but
yeah.
Now,
you're
the
so
tie up of the story is, leaving the church, I had not cried. I'm carrying his coffin outside the church with the other pallbearers. And when we get outside the church, where thousands of people, the little people that couldn't get in the church, right? The people that Frank always was so gracious to. And they were cheering and cheering and cheering. Long live Frank Sinatra. God bless you, Frank Sinatra, as we're putting his coffin in the hearse. And that's when tears just came down. I could not hold back the tears because I'm thinking about all those people out there that he would have loved this so much, how much they appreciated what he contributed to this world. You know?
Wow. How much older was he than you, Tom?
Wow. I think he was about 30 years older than me. I started touring with him. Yeah. He was about 28, 30 years older than me. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but not a father figure, really more of a
friend. Well, he was a friend, but toward the end of his life, he came more like a father figure. That's when he would give me advice and stuff. You know, I learned so much from him. You know, I'll tell you a quick story. One time we were coming out of the Waldorf Astoria in New York, and we were on our way to a gig. And we went out the back door because if Frank went out the front, he'd get mobbed. And security was rushing us to the limo. And a woman jumped out of the doorway. The doorman told me she had been hiding there for 5 hours. And she's yelling, Mr. Sinatra, please, Mr. Sinatra, please, please. As we were getting into the limo, she kept screaming, please, Mr. Sinatra. And the security was holding her back. Frank turned around and he walked all the way back to her. And he said, what is it? She said, my husband is home sick. And I could get an autograph from you. He's terribly ill. It would mean the world to him. And Frank said, sure. And Frank signing the autograph, and he had on cufflinks that cost well over $1,000. They're very expensive cufflinks. I know where he got them. He was signing the autograph. She said, oh, what beautiful cufflinks. He said, thank you. He finished the autograph, and he took the cufflinks off, and he handed them to her and said, give these to your husband. She said, oh, no, no, no. I don't want them. I was just admiring them. He said, no, I want your husband to have these. When we got in the limo, I said, Frank, that was beautiful, but why did you do that? He said, Tommy, if you possess something that you can't give away, you don't possess it. It possesses you. I never forgot that he later said to me, he said, Tommy, Aristotle and Onassis had billions of dollars, private jets, yachts, mansions. The second he died, all of that transferred. That wasn't his yacht. That wasn't his mansion. That wasn't his jets. It transfers. So nothing we have is ours. We're only using it. These are the kind of lessons he taught me. And the very last time, his 82nd birthday, I went over his house. And he wasn't quite well. He died 5 months later. And some days he would be with us and some days he wouldn't. He'd be in and out. And this night we weren't sure. Everybody had something to eat. We were waiting for the cake to come out. He was off to the side. The woman, a black woman named Vine, who used to take care of him, was cutting up some food, helping him. He was getting kind of feeble and he hadn't said anything. So we didn't know if he was quite with us. And somebody stopped making small talk, waiting for the cake to come out. Gregory Peck said, somebody said, where's the best place to live? And Gregory Peck said, well, Veronique and I have a villa in France, and we like it there. Robert Wagner and Jill St. John said, we have a home in Aspen, and we like it there. And Frank, with his head down, off to the side, said, the best place to live is where your friends are. And everybody went, whoa, whoa, yeah, of course. Now, my point of this is, here's a man, arguably the greatest career show business has ever known. Oscars, Emmys, Grammys, he did it all. you know, the amassed a fortune. But in the end, it wasn't about any of those things. It was about friendships, relationships. That's the last lesson Frank Sinatra ever taught me.
Wow, that's really beautiful. Boy, Tom, does anybody still call you Tommy? Is it always Tom now?
Frank Sinatra called me Tommy, and so did my mom. Tommy, come back. Yeah. You know, every night when I'd leave the stage, he would come on, and the band would be vamping. He'd get the center stage. He'd say, Tommy, come back and take another bow. Tom, there he is. There's my man. There's my number one guy. Tommy, take a bow. So I get it. Tommy's fine.
That's adorable. Yeah. Now I've always respected him as well. I never understood, like, I mean, I know maybe this is, and I can cut this if you want me to, but you know, when you see his son, Mia Farrow's son, you know, in the writer, I can't even think of his name right now, but he looks just like Frank Sinatra. And that's kind of like a rumor, but it was never confirmed. Why would you think they would not confirm that?
He isn't Frank Sinatra's son, in my opinion, even though he's got those blue eyes, but so did Mia's family have those blue eyes. You know, at the time that they would have consummated that affair, I don't think it was happening for Frank. But the other thing is, do you think if you were really Frank Sinatra's son, you wouldn't know that? You wouldn't want to know that? That he wouldn't have gone to take a test and know that for sure?
Well, I think that they do know. I think somehow it's scandalous. I mean, but because he looks identical.
Well, I'm talking about him. Why wouldn't he want everybody to know? If he went and took a test, it wouldn't be that hard to find out, you know?
Well, I guess it's because I think he is hiding something. He doesn't want to let that out to his mother. Or I don't know. I think that there's a... It doesn't matter, but it just seems like Frank Sinatra was a really good man. I mean, sure, he had some ghosts in the closet or whatever, but I mean, he was a great guy. And so, yeah who wouldn't want to? That's exactly what I say. Why would?
Is his name Ronan?
Yeah,
is
Ronan that Farrow. That's it. Yeah.
Now, why wouldn't Ronan take that test? What if Ronan wasn't Frank Sinatra's son and wasn't Woody Allen's son either? Was somebody else's son?
Right. So he's protecting his mom. Fair enough.
Yeah. What if he was somebody's son that he wished he was? It's better to have the mystery that you might be Frank Sinatra's son than to find out for sure you're not. I don't believe for one second he's Frank Sinatra's son. But
wow.
But what do I know? I don't have a degree from academia, but I got a doctorate from the streets.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. He ain't Woody Allen's son. There ain't no way that offspring came down that way, because Ronan Farrow is a fine looking man.
Yeah, he really is. He's a good looking guy. And a good guy. I've never met.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and brilliant.
Really?
I've never met him, but
anyway, who knows? Tom Dreesen, I can't thank you enough, sir. Really. You have been it's just been a wonderful, wonderful time hearing you and your stories. And I have a whole new level of respect for Frank Sinatra.
Well, I want to say this to you also. Why your dad loved Frank Sinatra is why most people who love Frank Sinatra, was a soundtrack. His music was a soundtrack of their lives.
Yeah,
they went steady to his music. You know, when somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you. All the way. They got married to his music. Love and marriage, love. They got divorced to his music. That lonely guy in the bar. It's 2:45. There's no. They got remarried to his music. Love is lovelier the second time around. His music was a soundtrack of their lives. You know, when I left his house the day he died, I was driving out and there was a talk show on. And there was a woman called in, and it was all over the news that Frank Sinatra died. And this woman said, my husband came home from work today and he's in his room right now and he's sobbing. He didn't cry at his father's funeral. He served in Korea and he served in Vietnam. And I never saw the man weep. He's in his room right now sobbing because Frank Sinatra died.
Wow.
And she said, I don't understand why. And the guy didn't know, but if I could have called in, I knew. Frank Sinatra's music was the soundtrack of his life. If Frank was out there singing somewhere, anywhere in the world, if you're a housewife in Portland, Oregon, or a garage mechanic in Detroit, as long as Frank was out there singing, we were as young as we were the first time we heard his voice. As long as Frank was out there singing. When Frank Sinatra died, you know, a part of us died. Because his music, like I say, was a soundtrack of our life. We all knew that the next day the sun was going to shine. It just wasn't going to be as warm as it was before.
Tom Dreesen, this has been a really beautiful tribute. You've shared so much. Really, this is just beautiful. Thank you so much.
Well, I gave you enough for four two-hour specials.
I'm telling you. And I hope you'll come on that show I have on Sunday nights. And if you're not doing anything, 6 p.m. on a Sunday night, you come on, tell a 10-minute story. We would love that.
Sure. You set it up. I'll do it for you.
Thank you so much, Tom. All right, you guys, we got to wrap it up. One more time on behalf of the very talented Tom Dreesen. Thank you so much for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Amazon.com, still standing.
That's it. You got to get that book, you guys. My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.